This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 4, 2004. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Yasser Arafat marks his 75th birthday today amidst a crisis in the Fatah movement. Families of victims in Argentina organize against police torture and murder, and Washington, D.C. says goodbye to sister space and books. But first, these headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. 12 Iraqis were killed and 26 wounded in gun battles today in Mosul. Sporadic violence occurred throughout the city, and the provincial government imposed a curfew. Also today in Iraq, a government official says an amnesty offer for rebels will not cover fighters who've killed. The amnesty has been repeatedly delayed, and each new version narrows the list of those eligible. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets in Khartoum in protest of the possible military intervention by the United Nations. Heder Rizvi reports from the UN, however, that diplomats there say this kind of move is not imminent.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said today, these demonstrations in Khartoum were not unexpected. Without naming Sudan, he said, sometimes governments use these demonstrations to put pressure on the United Nations. Annan warned the Sudanese government against delay in meeting the requirements of the one-month deadline, saying if they fail to perform, there will be consequences. The Security Council passed a resolution on July 30, giving Sudan 1 month in which to disarm the Janjaweed militia and bring its leaders to justice for committing human rights violations in the Darfur region. Annan confirmed that the African Union is considering sending additional troops to oversee a ceasefire between government troops and rebels. Responding to a question about the obligations of the Sudanese government, he said he doesn't think the council asked them to complete disarmament in 1 month, but he added they should be able to take steps to calm the situation, to stop the attacks, to protect the people, and continue the disarmament. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
Three British citizens released from Guantanamo Bay without charge in March released a 115-page report today that details their first full account of their ordeal as terror suspects. Naomi Fowler has more from London.
The three men were held for 2 years before being released. They allege they were repeatedly beaten, humiliated, shackled in painful positions during interrogations, and subjected to sleep deprivation. In an echo of the abuse scandal at Abu Ghraib jail in Baghdad, which shamed Washington, the men say they were photographed naked and subjected to unnecessary anal searches. All three confessed falsely to being in a video with Osama bin Laden because of the pain and ill treatment they were subjected to. The dossier also alleges complicity by Britain in their treatment. The men challenge claims by the Foreign Office that no Briton had complained of their treatment in Guantanamo. They say they complained many times to a British embassy official and to their British interrogators. The Ministry of Defence has said it will investigate. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The Securities and Exchange Commission announced today that drug giant Bristol-Myers Squibb has been fined $150 million to settle federal regulators' charges that it manipulated its inventory of medicines in a fraudulent scheme to inflate earnings. In other action by the SEC, the commission subpoenaed documents from Halliburton and expanded a probe of payments related to a $5 billion construction contract in Nigeria. The SEC also levied a $7.5 million fine against Halliburton. Aaron Glantz reports.
The fine settles charges of misleading accounting when Dick Cheney was CEO of Halliburton. Cheney was in charge of the company from 1995 until 2000 when he became vice president. The SEC said profits revealed in Halliburton's 1998 report were almost 50% higher than Halliburton initially revealed. A grand jury is also looking at possible dealings between Halliburton and Iran through a Cayman Islands subsidiary. The company denies any U.S. laws have been broken. In addition, the Pentagon and Justice Department are probing allegations that KBR, another Halliburton subsidiary that secured an oil supply contract in Iraq, may have overcharged the U.S. government by $61 million. Halliburton is also being investigated for overpricing meals served by KBR to U.S. troops in Iraq and Kuwait. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
Missouri voters overwhelmingly approved a state constitutional amendment yesterday that bans same-gender marriages. Voters in at least 9 other states, and perhaps as many as 12, are expected to consider similar amendments this fall. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
Hearings continue today at Capitol Hill on the 9/11 Commission's recommendations to decrease the chance of a terrorist attack in the United States. Congressional Democrats are calling for the quick implementation of many of the recommendations. However, concerns still linger. Former FBI translator Sybil Edmonds, who was fired after questioning FBI tactics and then silenced by the Justice Department, wrote an open letter to the commission in which she accuses it of omitting important information. Mitch Jezerich has more.
Former FBI translator Sybil Edmonds has been silenced by the Justice Department from discussing details which she says shows that the FBI botched the investigation into the 9/11 attacks. Edmonds, who testified in a closed 9/11 commission session, published an open letter on Monday to the commission's chair. Edmonds wrote that the final report ignored problems within the FBI's counterterrorism and counterintelligence efforts. Thus, she says, the commission's recommendations, such as creating an intelligence czar, are off point.
Here we are 3 years after 9/11, and none of these problems have been addressed. They have not been resolved. Now, throwing more budget, placing another layer of bureaucracy, is not going to address these problems. It's like having a car with engine problem and then deciding to put a sunroof on this car and change its
Edmonds wrote in her letter, which can be found online at commondreams.org, that just a month after 9/11, the FBI's largest translation unit was covering up past failures, blocking important leads, and jeopardizing ongoing investigations. Edmonds says much information was purposefully blocked so to safeguard diplomatic relations with foreign countries. None of this is in the 9/11 report. Sybil Edmonds.
He lost 3,000 people on that date. You're talking about under threat, under this terrorist threat, yet they are protecting certain diplomatic relations, not pursuing these investigations, and they are not even disclosing this to the people. People don't know. They are not letting the people know. They are not even, in certain cases, let the Congress know. And these are unwritten procedures and unwritten policies followed, and many agents there are as frustrated as I am.
Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the House Intelligence Committee heard testimony over the 9/11 Commission's recommendations, but the ranking Democrat on the committee, Jane Harman of California, says there's been enough talk and that it's time to work on specific measures.
I believe we ignore their recommendations at our peril. Mr. Chairman, it has been nearly 3 years since the tragic events of September 11, 2001. 3 years of bipartisan panels and commissions, hearings and reports. It is now time to act.
However, many witnesses who testified to the committee urged lawmakers to take time in considering intelligence and security reforms and to try not to get caught up in a highly charged political environment. Former General William Odin served under the Reagan administration as director of the National Security Agency.
We're in a war. We will take a few casualties. But look at Britain and its struggle with the IRA for years. They don't run around following a policy of sustained hysteria about it. They've taken some pretty serious hits. But you get used to it, you keep it down, and you learn to not let the other guy force you to squander your resources.
Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. State Department has warned Israel to stop a plan to build hundreds of new housing units in the West Bank and honor its commitment to end expansions in the area. Meanwhile, Yasser Arafat celebrates his birthday today with a crisis within his own Fatah movement. For that reason, Egypt has postponed inter-Palestinian dialogue until the situation has cleared. Dr. Hassam Abu Libde is Cabinet Secretary of the Palestinian Authority. He joins us today to talk about the situation in Palestine and Israel. Now, although the U.S. State Department is speaking out against these new settlements, it's not the first time that they have done so. Does it really mean anything? Will it make Israel stop and abide by their prior commitment to the area?
Well, it all depends whether Israel is interested in peace on a strategic level or not. The settlement activities in the West Bank is only increasing the hostilities, increasing the difficulties for both nations. The recent announcement of building 600 units in the Jerusalem area is a reflection of the plans of the Israeli government to expand all around Jerusalem and annex it. And this will only complicate the situation and make it much more difficult for the two parties to come together. So I really hope that the American administration will be able to use its leverage that is available on the Israelis to make sure that the Israeli government understands that commitments towards the American administration have to be respected.
And we've heard a lot about the Fatah movement recently. Can you explain the differences between the new and old guard within the movement and what this means for Arafat's position?
Well, first of all, this notion of old and new guard refers to the fact that there are at least three generations within the Fatah movement. And this refers to those founding fathers of the Fatah movement are referred to as the old guards, and all the new generations are referred to as the new guards. But this is on the surface. Deep down, I think what's happening in the Fatah is not really a serious dissent in terms of, you know, one faction within the movement is trying to take over the movement against the other one. There is, of course, some discontent with the fact that the elections within Fatah haven't been, you know, taken place for the last 15 years. And it's only natural for those members who have been around waiting for these years to assume higher positions to show dissent. But this is not going to undermine the authority of Arafat only. It's going to undermine the authority of the whole Fatah movement, because all these problems within the movement will only escalate the situation internally and make it much more difficult for the movement to gain seats in any new elections which are due to be held in the next few months.
Dr. Hassam Aboulebda is the chief secretary of the Palestinian Authority. He joined us today from Jerusalem. The World Bank issued its reaction to an internal review of its investments in oil, mining, and gas sectors. While the bank has made many proposals that move toward revising its current practices, it has refused to take up the most serious of the review's conclusions of phasing out investment in extractive industries altogether. To critics, the bank's reaction means a persistence of business as usual. FSRN's Jenny Johnson reports.
The Extractive Industry Review was commissioned by the World Bank to assess its role in the funding of oil, gas, and mining projects. And the findings, released in April, recommend the adoption of numerous revisions to the bank's current lending standards. The bank has long been criticized for its role in extractive projects in the developing world because such projects are often found to be harmful to the health of local communities, indigenous cultures, and the environment. Among the World Bank Group Board's proposals are increased emphasis in investment in cleaner fuel and renewable energy alternatives, improving environmental standards and social safeguards, and increasing transparency in revenue flows.
They've found what I'm sure they consider a middle road. They've decided to reject the really difficult recommendations and just adopt in some manner some of the easier ones.
Nadia Martinez, Latin American coordinator for the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network of the Institute for Policy Studies, is one of many critics who are not satisfied with the World Bank's action on the review's recommendations.
We're saying they're missing the opportunity to really do something, to have their activities come in line with their mission. Their mission is poverty alleviation. They should adopt all of the conclusions in the entirety, not just little pieces here and there so that they say that they did something, but they didn't do anything really serious.
One major area of dispute is the review's conclusions that the bank's funding of extractive projects does not achieve its mission of alleviating poverty, so it recommended it should phase out such investments altogether. The World Bank does not agree with this conclusion. Two other detailed reports by the bank's internal evaluation group, according to Clive Armstrong, lead economist with the World Bank Group's Oil, Gas, Mining, and Chemicals Department, came to different conclusions.
And that found that in more than 70% of projects that the bank did, the outcomes were actually very satisfactory from the perspective of development, impact, and poverty alleviation. However, we recognize that we can do better, and the proposals that we're taking forward now are intended to make sure that the impact on poverty development, poverty reduction, and on economic, sustainable economic development are better.
How the bank will specifically act amidst their proposals for change is not clear. Shannon Lawrence, international policy analyst for the group Environmental Defense, gives an example of the uncertainties in creating new governance indicators for structuring projects.
When will the World Bank not support an oil, mining, and gas project? That's not an answer that we have coming out of this review. Again, they're arguing for a flexible case-by-case approach. They say that they will evaluate governance before they go in and assess governance and make their assessments of governance levels public. So presumably, they would look at risks of conflict and other factors. But it's not clear then, where is a minimum level? When is it so bad in a country that the World Bank will not support an oil, mining, and gas project there? That's not clear.
The bank's proposals are undergoing more specific reviews from its managers in the coming weeks. Meanwhile, civil society groups are underscoring that there are ways the bank can meet the goals of its mission instead of funding projects which simply benefit international corporations in the West. Again, Lawrence.
Most of the World Bank's oil mining and gas projects are actually for export. They're not for providing local energy services. And in that case, if these projects are about providing revenue to governments, then there are certain conditions that should be in place to ensure that these revenues will be used to benefit the poor.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Jenny Johnson.
After a long battle, U.S. Marshals evicted African-American-owned business Sister Space and Books from a historically black community in Washington, D.C. yesterday. Local community activists and supporters claim Sister Space and Books is the latest victim of the U Street Corridor gentrification. Karen Mitchell has more.
Sister Space and Books co-owners Faye Williams and Cassandra Burton were evicted from 1515 U Street in Northwest Washington, D.C. Tuesday morning by United States Marshals. The eviction comes just days after the bookstore owners announced receipt of almost $1 million from an anonymous angel investor. By Tuesday morning, Sister Space's investment funds had risen to $2.3 million, and according to Sister Space and Books volunteers, Williams and Burton were in negotiations with the building owners since Friday to purchase the building, creating a permanent space for the African-American female-owned business on the U Street corridor. A day before the scheduled eviction, U.S. Marshals contacted the property owners' lawyers to confirm whether the building owners wanted to go forward with the eviction. The U.S. Marshals were given go-ahead Monday. Tricia Kinge is a community activist who also volunteered at Sister Space since the store first opened its doors. Tricia Kinge.
It's really about who is going to control U Street. We're not going to let our precious institutions be destroyed by a bunch of people who don't even live in this city.
Stephen O. Hessler, counsel to the building owners, said this is not an issue of gentrification. The trust is not interested in selling the building to anyone. Stephen Hessler.
A few minutes ago in this conversation, you said, well, gee, what about this $2.3 million? Thank you very much. I'm learning more about what Sister Space's financial intentions are from media reporters and television interviewers than I am from their own lawyer.
The eviction of Sister Space and Books from the historically black community comes after several years of out-of-court and in-court battles. In May, D.C. Superior Court Judge Brooke Hedge ruled Williams and Burton no longer held legal rights to the property because their original lease had expired in October 2002. For a number of reasons, including building repairs, Sister Space said were ignored, Williams and Burton had begun withholding rent, the landlord and tenants had begun a series of negotiations over several years, and in the process, a new lease had never been agreed upon and signed. Subsequently, the bookstore was placed on an eviction list, and the physical eviction was carried out Tuesday. The historically black region in Northwest D.C. is known as the place where black families would go to get their hair done, listen to musicians like Billie Holiday, or eat at Ben's Chili Bowl. Today, apartment buildings named after Duke Ellington and businesses like a sun tanning salon are being built on the corridor. According to the Washington Post, only 1/4 of the retail businesses in the Ellington building are not owned by people of color or are not serving a community function. David Garrison, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, works for the Metropolitan Policy Program. David Garrison.
In terms of the growth in the value of the real estate, that's a process that, as you know, that is a product of this strong economy in which we sit, and in that sense, somewhat of a natural process. It does place a lot of pressure on folks who are living, particularly in rental situations, where the owner of the property decides they can get more rent, and so renters are the ones who are first to feel the effects of this upward movement in real estate prices.
With tears in their eyes, the bookstore owners, community activists, volunteers, as well as local tenants and business owners, loaded boxes of books, furniture, and other items into moving vans and cars. The banner bearing the name Sister Space, which had been draped across the storefront, was removed. Sister Space co-owners and their legal representatives were not available for comment. I'm Karen Mitchell reporting from Washington, D.C.
As questions of validity have risen about the terror alerts in New York City, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C., so have questions of civil liberties as heavily armed officers infiltrate the streets of these densely populated areas. From WBAI in New York, Leanne Caldwell has more.
Over the weekend, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly announced reports of terrorist threats that give specific locations of attacks. But Mayor Bloomberg said this information might be old.
We don't know when the information was collected. Some of this information could have been collected over the last few years. So what is different today with this report is, for the first time, we see a report that identifies specific targets.
The New York Times and the Washington Post reported yesterday that intelligence officials said the terror alerts are not recent alerts and may be up to 5 years old. Tom Ridge, director of Homeland Security, defended the terror alert, saying that the information might be dated, but is still urgent because of the specificity. The Associated Press reports today that the intelligence investigators are intensely dissecting documents to determine the report's accuracy. They are looking into documents unveiled in Pakistan that refer to the bombing of financial buildings in New York, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C., but officials are unsure if the plot is still relevant. As the relevance of the reports are being investigated, New York City officials are taking the threat seriously. Heavily armed guards and special anti-terrorism units have been deployed around the New York Stock Exchange, other financial institutions, and historic landmarks. They closed roads and allow limited traffic on the bridges and through the tunnels.
But let me assure all New Yorkers of one thing. We are deploying our full array of counterterrorism resources. Even as we prepare for the Republican National Convention at the end of this month, we have ramped up security even further at the named location.
But civil liberties advocates are closely watching the city's security practices, especially as the Republican National Convention comes to town. In a news conference in front of City Hall, Congressman Charles Rangel, Democrat from New York, voiced concern that the increased security will impede on people's constitutional rights.
Now we have an alert that was created either by Ridge or by Cove indicating that our lives are threatened and probably will be threatened until the election is over. Having said that, there's some of us that believe that threat or no threat, terrorism or no terrorism, that this Constitution has to live.
Hundreds of thousands of protesters are expected to denounce President Bush and the GOP. The New York Civil Liberties Union worries that the terror alert will excuse the city from overstepping the law in dealing with protesters. Bob Perry, legislative director of the NYCLU.
Particularly in times of heightened security and political ferment, it's especially important that the city take steps to balance these interests and that safety concerns not become a pretext for security measures that unnecessarily frustrate or deny participation in First Amendment activity.
They sent a letter to the mayor asking the city to allow easy access to protest sites and adhere to a court order that restricts unnecessary searches, the use of interlocking metal barricades, and the use of unnecessary force. In addition, the New York Civil Liberties Union is holding seminars to let citizens know their rights if they are approached by a uniformed officer, whether they are walking to work or protesting the GOP. For Free Speech Radio News in New York City, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Argentine Human Rights Group Coordinated Against Police and Institutional Repression, or COREPI for its Spanish acronym, released a report last year that states one person is murdered by authorities in that country every 60 hours. This year, civilian assassinations at the hands of authorities, a phenomenon known as gatillo fácil or happy trigger, are still on the rise. From Buenos Aires, Matt Goldin and Zula Workin have more.
COREPI focuses on the fight against repression on the part of state authorities. For the past 8 years, COREPI has documented so-called happy trigger and torture cases. So far, they have documented 1,600 murders committed by the police. Although this number does not reflect every case, since many victims' relatives do not report murders and tortures. Gerardo Echeverri is an attorney with the Correpi.
Happy Trigger is not what the authorities says it is, like the action of one madman or one isolated personality. Instead, it is one of the many systematical practices of security forces, practices sanctioned by the state, such as torture and other practices of social control that are in use today.
Happy Trigger and torture practices have risen in the last years and now averages 11 cases per month. This in a society where more than 50% of the population lives below the poverty line, and the poor often wait years to see their assailants and tortures brought to justice. Carla Lacorte is a young university student who has waited nearly 3 years for the trial of the policeman that shot her in the back.
I was returning from the university and an official from Es Paletas police station shot me in the back, assuming that I was an accomplice in an assault, and left me in a wheelchair. 3 years have passed and he continues working in his capacity as an officer. We are fighting so that at the very least they remove him from his post at the station. The district attorney and the judges have done nothing to reconstruct the evidence and to show that he, in fact, intended to kill me.
The mass media's role in these matters is decisive. Many have tight relationships with police and often report on gunfire before that the district attorney has an opportunity to review the case. Mariano Bogado's brother, Marcelo, was a young man murdered by the police in Villa Tesey 2 months ago under strange circumstances.
They handcuffed Marcelo, put him on his knees and started beating him. His face was disfigured and his hands were bruised by handcuffs. He had a shot in the forehead and another one in the neck. While they had him on his knees, he turned to say that he was innocent and the policeman shot him in the neck. While he was agonizing, the cop finished him off with a shot to the forehead. The next day, newspapers reported that there was gunfire between a suspect and the police, and there was a dead man. The only witnesses who saw what happened to Marcelo were threatened. Now the witnesses' security is our insecurity. So in the end, Marcelo was a victim of security.
Authorities took 18 days to take action in the case. 1 month after Marcelo's death, his family, friends and neighbors demonstrated at the Door police station, where the policeman who killed Marcelo, Officer Cesar Luis Diaz, still works on duty. The case garnered mass media attention only after the police station was attacked when stone and paint were thrown during a protest march. Families of victims of Happy Trigger have begun to organize in their neighborhood and to demonstrate at police station doors. Murder is not the only security force practice. Torture is also common in police stations. Andrea Viera was detained in the province of Buenos Aires as a suspect in a theft. While she was detained, she was tortured. She was in coma 12 days and died in the hospital. The two police women who tortured her remain free to this day. 2 years after his murder, her sister Eugenia said this in the doors of the police station where she was tortured.
First of all, if we're talking about insecurity, then I have to say I feel really insecure, because insecurity is impunity. It's hunger and unemployment. We know that the solution is not more cops on the streets. We know that if these things happen, it's because historically it was judges and attorneys that allowed it to happen. They closed cases and did not allow investigations.
The relatives of the victims now look to Correpi to help them face the battles against police violence and continue fighting for justice against the repression of youth throughout the country. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Matt Goldin and Zula Warken from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.